B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who knows the door code to every on-course restroom in the Southeast, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, I certainly hope I'm not the first, but let me be the latest to wish you and yours the happiest and most prosperous of New Year's. You know, as I was sitting around with friends over the holidays discussing quote-unquote New Year's resolutions, one that caught me off guard but was almost universal, read more. With this job, I'm reading all the time. And so with this final Best Of show before we kick things into high gear next week, I wanted to spotlight two books from the world of golf last year that I cannot recommend highly enough. First up, the great Kurt Sampson pointing his often savagely critical eye and perspective towards Tiger Woods with Roaring Back, The Fall and Rise of Tiger Woods. And also a longtime friend of the show, University of Texas professor Kevin Robbins, whose book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year Golf Changed Forever. It spoke to me in a way that few books have. And we spoke earlier this year in one of the more meaningful conversations that I had. First up, though, Kurt Sampson on Tiger Woods. Kurt, as I mentioned to you when I was setting this up, I've been a great admirer of your work for many years, mostly because, in my opinion, you are the first, and I can't think of another word for it, fearless author of golf nonfiction. For example, I remember my father gifting me your biography of Hogan. This was the first I'd ever heard the story of Ben witnessing the suicide of his father and you tracing his life's attitude and behaviors to this moment. It probably got you off the Hogan family Christmas card list. I was living and working in Augusta when the Masters came out. You told stories and truths that I'd only heard about in back rooms. I feel absolutely certain you were excommunicated from the Masters Christmas card list. So when I read about this book on Tiger, my first reaction was, wow, I wonder what's going to be in here. But then my second thought was, after reading Armin's book a year ago, what's really left to know? So my first question to you is simply this. Why this book on Tiger? What was your angle? What's your reason for wanting to do it?
Thank you, first of all, Charlie, for those kind words about my work. Yes, I'm fearless, or I don't know. I guess I bore easily, and layers of PR just put me to sleep. I can't read them. I don't want to write them. My reason for writing this book had everything to do with what happened in April. Remember, Tiger had teed us up by winning the 2018 Tour Championship in Atlanta. So there was great anticipation for this year's Masters because Tiger was going to be in the mix again. And then he didn't disappoint. Half the book is instant nostalgia for that amazing tournament that had twists and turns, and for Tiger, the greatest piece of luck or four pieces of luck he's ever had when Koepka, Molinari, Finau, and to a lesser extent, Ian Poulter all hit it in the water on number 12.
As I mentioned, I was living and working in Augusta in the mid-90s. I was there in 97. I remember everything about that week and that Sunday in particular. However, you brought up a name early on in your book, and I had forgotten it, and I think my mind had blocked it out because from a local standpoint, it was so tragic, and that being the name of Alan Caldwell. I remember thinking at the time that if what Alan was doing wasn't in the gray area between legal and illegal, an ambitious attorney might have wanted to go after Nike as an accessory to his death. Sort of explain what Alan's business was and what happened to him in 1997.
Mr. Caldwell was among those who would contact people who owned badges for the week, often local people in Augusta, pay them, let's keep the numbers round, pay them $3,000.
That sounds about right.
A nice profit for the badge holder. And then he would then, as middleman, sell it to usually a corporate entity for $5,000, let's say. But this particular year, 97, was so overheated, as you just alluded to, the numbers got really high, really fast, when person after person who'd promised Mr. Caldwell a badge reneged and sold them themselves or did something not involving him. he was left out to dry in a financial sense in a very big way. I think he was going to have to make people whole. In other words, pay them for badges he wasn't providing. It got to be too much for him. I didn't know the man. He killed himself during that Masters. He was a friend of a number of my friends, and I found myself in a funeral home on that Saturday morning, just shocked, and met his shocked family. I'll never forget it.
Kurt Sampson is the author of Roaring Back. He's our guest, taking Dead Aim. You know, between Alan Caldwell, and I know personally a half dozen people, if not more, I don't know how much they're able to do it now as the club has seemingly encroached upon everybody else's entrepreneurship. But I knew, you know, 12, 15 people who made their living off of that 1 week in Augusta in some way, shape, or form. A lot of it due to, you know, badge acquirement and resale and whatnot. You mentioned in your book, another friend of mine we were just talking about off air, a guy named Clyde Pilcher, who basically invented the badge reselling business. Is there not a book to be written, perhaps, about this hidden market that may not exist anymore, but there were some glory years in Augusta of people who literally made their living working for half the year leading up to that week at the Masters, and then for the rest of the year just kind of took it easy?
A book could be. You know, we just need to think of the title. Boy, it's a target-rich environment. So many people supplemented their income. It wouldn't have been enough for a year, but scores, maybe hundreds of people rented out the space in their front yards for you for $5 or $10 to park there. It was a very jolly thing for them to make some folding money, some cash during Masters Week. A lot of my friends in Augusta just missed the old tournament before it became a lot more corporate. They liked that the beer was in glass bottles. They liked that there were more beer stands. they liked that you could get beer at the par three tournament, which you can't anymore. Geez, I'm just giving you beer-oriented comments here.
No, it speaks to my soul. Keep going.
But it was a more charming time. I think it's so different now. I give you as Exhibit A Berkman's Place, which is a collection of five-star restaurants and high-end entertainment, including replica Augusta National Greens, within a little compound. I can't remember exactly where it is, kind of behind number four and five.
Yeah, it's near five. It's behind the fence at five.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not like old times. But time marches on, and the such as Billy Payne have their maximizers. It's with unlimited budget, so still a great tournament, the greatest tournament by my lights.
Kurt Sampson is the author of Roaring Back, our guest taking Dead Aim. Thank you for bringing up Billy Payne. So much of Tiger, I guess, when his history is written in the end, because of 97 and what happened this last year, so much of it is going to be intrinsically tied to Augusta National. But thank you for bringing up Billy. I was more than pleased to see throughout your book that you still have a fondness for tweaking the noses of the men of the Masters here and there. I've been around a lot of chairmen over the years, none of which seem to bask in the title nor claim more sanctimonious high ground than one Billy Payne. Now, I'm not saying he didn't do a lot of work for the game. I believe his work with the Asian and South American amateurs, drive, chip, and putt, fabulous for growing the game. But he had a truly annoying habit of using his title for a pulpit that you apparently find as off-putting as I did.
Yeah, here was Tiger. Let's fast forward from 97 up to what this event, 2010.
The 2010 Masters, yeah.
Yeah, this is immediately the first Masters post scandal. And Billy had to make a great show of publicly reprimanding Tiger, this guy who had been ashamed for months. His family had been destroyed because of his actions. He'd had to endure several months of sex addiction clinic in Mississippi, and I'm not sure which is worse, the Mississippi or the clinic. That was just a joke, Mississippi. Billy Payne decided that he needed to make Tiger the subject of his annual State of the Masters speech on Wednesday of the tournament, and he required Tiger to come up to his office somewhere on the grounds there and take a knee and ask for forgiveness. It's an annoying thing. The pomposity in all its forms just rubs me the wrong way, and if I can point it out, I will.
Does it strike you as odd that Tiger did that? I mean, Tiger, to me, is still in the position of power. What was Billy Payne going to do, say, I disagree with the way he handled himself so he's not coming to our tournament? No, he's not going to do that.
True enough, but let's remember, Tiger was beaten down at this moment. He was had to be at a low ebb. We forget, I forget sometimes, too, that our sports heroes are just as human as you and me and can feel just as low as we do when we have a setback. I have a feeling Tiger felt a bit like a punching bag at that moment. Came out, you know, the next day sporting wraparound sunglasses, kind of trying to hide in public. I think he was very chastened.
Kurt Sampson is the author of Roaring Back. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Throughout your book, you bring up stories of other golfers that had overcome great adversity in their lives to achieve great things. A couple of fellow Texans, I'm partial like that, Hogan and Babe Diedrichson Zaharias, Calvin Pete, a very interesting story of a Special Forces soldier who went from wounded warrior with PTSD to a scratch golfer and instructor. But in doing so, I was trying to figure out what you were, implying here. Am I correct in assuming that you consider the hoop around what Tiger did overrated when compared to what these other people overcame?
A fair question, Charlie. But no, the man who took a bullet in the brain in Afghanistan and then had a remarkable recovery, his story, his comeback story has a particular flavor. And Tiger's has its flavor, too. But Tiger... you know, it wasn't illness or injury that the guy had to come back from. Really, to me, it was that he was a laughingstock. You recall, Leno, Letterman, any late-night comedian, for a couple of months was leading off the monologue with, well, I see Tiger has another mistress. What is that, number 22? You know, those stories belittled him. He was, I guess he probably deserved to become a laughingstock. But if you've ever been ridiculed and laughed at and felt your cheeks burn with shame, I'm one of seven kids, so I knew this feeling when I was young. It's a considerable thing to ignore the taunts and the other people's attitudes and never lose your self-belief. To me, that's the amazing part of Tiger's comeback. Not coming back from DUI or the sex scandal or the back operation, or hell, nine operations now. It's that he came back from being a laughingstock.
That's Kurt Sampson, and when we return, he continues to take dead aim at his book, Roaring Back, The Fall and Rise of Tiger Woods, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors, continuing now with Kurt Sampson, author of Roaring Back, The Fall and Rise of Tiger Woods. Tiger's father died in what, 06?
No. More recently than that. Wait a minute. Maybe you're... I'll bow to you on that. I thought it was a year or two later than that, but I could easily be wrong.
Yeah, because I think he died, and then he won it at Hoy Lake. That year in 06. Tiger's world really started to fall apart in 09, and I wonder if you feel about this. I've sort of had a theory about this. Look, Earl was an imperfect man. There's no question about that. Earl was pretty much what Tiger, do as I say, not as I do. And so it's for that reason that I can use the term moral compass when it came to Tiger Woods. You know, Earl was his true north. Do you think Tiger's world would have fallen apart like it did? He would have made the mistakes that he made had Earl still been there.
Great question. I hadn't considered that. I think you're probably on to something. It's too coincidental. While Tiger went on a great win streak soon after his father died, he eventually developed these obsessions. his SEAL training, for one thing. That's quite a direct salute to his late father. His father was a notable philanderer and didn't make very great attempts to hide it from anyone. And then Tiger went in that direction, too. I'm not saying that he was copying his dad specifically in either of those two things, but at minimum, it's an interesting coincidence. If Earl were still around, things might have happened in a slightly different way. I feel sorry for Tiger from reading Armin Katayan's biography of 3 or so years ago and learning about his home life, how his father belittled his mother in front of him, tossing F-bombs at her. I don't know what that would have done to me, but it had to do something to Tiger.
Kurt Sampson is the author of Roaring Back, our guest Taking Dead Aim. Speaking of his father, you bring up something that I've never seen articulated before, but I think it's an excellent hypothesis when it comes to trying to, you know, get Tiger. Quote, perhaps the best way to understand him is as the special ops military man his father was and that he wanted to be. Missions were defined and they were completed or they were not. When the mission is winning and you finish in a tie for sixth, well, you failed. Rory McIlroy was just named Player of the Year last year, mostly because of his top 10 finishes. I think he has 18 to date worldwide this year to go along with 4 wins. Tiger sees that as 4 wins and 14 complete failures, and to him that's unacceptable, and other people just aren't wired that way.
That's true enough. One of the mantras of the SEALs is second place is first loser. It's not to me. I'm happy with second place often in my life, in my modest competitive life. But with this military point of view the Tiger grew up with, you can see it. It's certainly served him well. I'm always a little, when I start to say anything with a negative tint about Tiger, I have to back off. I just consider the success the guy's had.
I want to ask you about something that people don't realize about endorsements, and it's not for everybody, but for people like Tiger it is. He gets paid a flat fee by, you name it, Nike, Bridgestone, Rolex, whoever's sponsoring him at the time. However, isn't he also paid a percentage based off brand exposure? And I bring this up because you state that off of this year's Masters, it's estimated Nike got roughly $22 million worth of exposure. What kind of extra check is in the mailbox for somebody like Tiger Woods who can point to $22 million worth of extra exposure?
You'd be surprised at how little I know about Tiger's financial life. Charlie, I don't know. I assume he gets a kicker. You would think,
right?
With a $22 million TV bonus for Nike, they got to give the that guy a little check in thank you. Boy, this stuff is kept track of really to the minute. If XYZ Pro is in contention, and they count the number of seconds the logo for whatever the sports drink he's got on his sleeve. That's all counted up. I think especially for the lesser pros, that is a straight line to a check. With Tiger, I'm not so sure, and I shouldn't speculate.
Kurt Sampson is the author of a fascinating new book about Tiger Woods called Roaring Back. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Post-Masters this year, Tiger receives the Presidential Medal of Freedom. For everyone else, the receipt of this honor has been about lifetime achievement. One, and you're right about this, Tiger's maintained he ain't done with his lifetime. But two, and I had never heard this, you opined that this could have been as much about a business partnership with President Trump in private life as any achievement on the golf course. Sort of explain what you mean by this.
Well, 2 years ago, possibly three, Tiger's company, his golf course design company, made a deal with Trump or Trump's associates who were building a golf course in the Middle East, Dubai, perhaps. I'm not exactly sure. Sorry for the.
Yeah, no, I think it was in Dubai. I think you're right.
Faulty memory. You know our president. He has not been shy about saying, Tiger's my architect. I'm in business with Tiger. I heard that many, many times. Tiger. I mean, Trump has, you know, borrowed Tiger's light, you know, on other occasions. For example, naming one of the buildings at Doral the Tiger Woods bungalow or something close to that. So it, when instead of a tea and a photo op at the White House to acknowledge Tiger's win at the Masters, for Trump to have the bigger deal, Presidential Medal of Freedom for his business partner, it looked like one hand washing the other. To some people, that's an inescapable. Could we use the Latin word quid pro quo here?
Yes.
I don't know. But I think it gave it a bad flavor. Tiger deserves any recognition, any honors and awards, but for the standard procedure to be upended, that is lifetime achievement, you know, the 70-year-old football player, the 80-year-old basketball player, the retiring whatever leader of any industry, for that to be stood on its ear, you know, had to make one examine the reasons for it.
Kurt, Tiger won 2 weeks ago in Japan. Anytime that happens, you start to get these glittering generalities and prognostications about what's left for Tiger to do. I maintain that anyone who thinks Tiger has 10 years left in him on the course is nuts. I think this is a small window of opportunity. I think we should all enjoy the hell out of it. Because when this one closes, it's over. There's not going to be any more that can be done. One of the big questions, of course, is his back and how bad it might, excuse the pun, roar on him in the future. You bring up something I'd never heard of before. It sounds painful as hell. What is adjacent segment disease?
After enduring an operation such as Tiger's had to his spine, in which vertebra were fused, the area that was cut on inevitably becomes arthritic, and there's also this syndrome you just mentioned. I don't know much about it except that it's painful, that the entire area becomes a little less usable. So Tiger, while super fit and absolutely dedicated to the workout, has extended his career into his 40s. He'll be 44 in a month. Which is amazing. His fitness level is incredible. But he's not exempt to aging or to the effects of major surgery like he had. I think he, this is a theory, Charlie, that the one tournament he might be able to stay quite competitive in for years to come might be the Masters. He has so many competitive rounds there. I think it's 86 plus umpteen practice and casual rounds there. He knows the course very well, probably better than anyone who's not a caddy or a member there. That's a big help. If he's willing to, you know, hit five wood as a second shot to number one and a full six iron for a third shot to number two, you know, I'm predicting a shorter ball off the tee. If he's willing to use that course knowledge and guile and experience, he could stay a factor there for a few more years.
Get you out of here on this. Kurt Sampson is the author of a fantastic new book on Tiger Woods called Roaring Back. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I want to harken back a little bit to a previous question. When taking all things into account, where do you rank the Tiger comeback in terms of others that you've mentioned in the game of golf?
Well, I took some pains to make the comebacks I showed quite different. One we mentioned, Sergeant Silton, who endured a sniper's bullet. Ben Hogan, everyone knows, a crash with a Greyhound bus with his car. Babe Zaharias won the U.S. Women's Open by 12 after cancer surgery and was on her last legs a year and a half later. And there's this other man we didn't mention, Skip Alexander, who was in a very good tour pro right around 1950, who was in a plane crash that burned 70% of his body, and he came back. Tiger's is so different from accident, injury, or illness. To me, again, it's that psychic, intellectual torment of being having been a hero, and to use the terrible cliche, now a zero, following his revelations of his appalling behavior So it's a different thing. I'm trying not to answer your question, Charlie, which is a very good one. I think today I don't want to rank them. I find them to be like five different flavors of ice cream, I guess.
The book Roaring Back, The Fall and Rise of Tiger Woods, the author, that's Kurt Sampson. And up next, this fall marked 20 years since we lost Payne Stewart. And Kevin Robbins joins us as we revisit a conversation where he takes dead aim at his tome, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year Golf Changed Forever. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Kevin Robbins is a longtime friend of the show and author of the definitive biography of legendary teaching pro Harvey Pinnick. This fall, he released a project that I know he'd been working on for years, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year Golf Changed Forever, and we had the chance to talk. Kevin, I know you've been working on this book for at least 2 years because I remember us talking about you working on this book for at least 2 years. When did the idea come to you and why? Was it, were you looking down the line at the 20-year anniversary of Payne's death, or what was the impetus for you to write this book?
Well, that wasn't really the impetus. It was kind of a nice coincidence, I guess, that we could finish it up in time for the anniversary when Payne was top of mind again. And so I wasn't really looking hard for another book idea, Charlie, but I was in front of my computer. It was a Saturday night in November of 2016, I think, and I just accidentally came across the final National Transportation Safety Board report of the flight and of October 25th, 1999, the one carrying Payne Stewart and five other people, including two pilots. And, you know, as government reports are, it was very detailed. There was not a story there, but there sure was a story to be told from this document, I thought. And the document had been released in its final form in 2005. So it came after the initial journalism about the death of Payne Stewart. It came out after Payne's wife, Tracy, had written the authorized biography. So I wondered if there were new ground to cover. There was lots. And also, I'm from Kansas City. I grew up in Missouri. Payne Stewart was someone I kept an eye on, and being from my home state. And so that's really how it started. And it started as a book about the flight of October 25, 1999. I should be transparent here. My agent quickly determined that wasn't a good book topic. It was a good magazine story maybe, but not a book topic. So I just started looking deeper and I looked backward and I thought about that season, and it was really such a good season in golf. The major championships were historic, each in its own way. And so that's how it began, and here we are.
The book is entitled The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, and that title takes on many different meanings when you read the book. It was his last year on tour, the last year of his career. It was the last moments of his life, that flight. There was the Ryder Cup concession to Colin Montgomery, sort of the last stand of golf congeniality in that. And then there was the last stand of his particular style of golf. And you go into detail about that, him and the Hal Suttons and the Azingers. This was 1999 as we were, you know, sort of segueing from the wound ball to the solid core ball, and the guys who played by feel, Corey Pavins in that group too, as opposed to the guys who began to overpower golf courses, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, etc. When did the title come to you, and when it did, was it after you had already considered all of these different things, or did it just sort of happen to fit that narrative?
It came rather late, actually. I think I was probably midway through the story, and it was untitled. I was thinking about a season narrative, a story of a season, and it's not so much that Payne was staging a stand, really. In other words, I don't see him as an aggressor. I see him almost as a defendant. And he was resisting this wave of he and his peers of that generation. And I would define that as players born before 1960. He was defending the game against this wave that was powerful and inevitable and unrestrainable. And it was personified by a 23-year-old Tiger Woods. And behind him, with him, 29-year-old Phil Mickelson and 19-year-old Sergio Garcia. These are all feel players, too. I want to be clear about that. They have their own sense of feel. But my point in making this part of Payne's story is that Payne Stewart and Sutton and O'Meara and Tom Lehman, Ben Crenshaw, Corey Pavin, as you mentioned, they learned golf with hard equipment to play. Steel shafts, forged iron heads, persimmon woods, round balls. The next generation, the younger guys, they learned with the equipment that made golf an easier game to play and that makes possible the golf that we see now on our televisions every weekend when Brooks Koepka hits a 3-wood 350 yards and Dustin Johnson plays par fives with wedges. So that's my point. I think there are both kinds of field players, but the field player in Payne Stewart and his generation, they had to learn a different kind of feel to move the ball around accurately with the equipment they learned with.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. As you look back on Payne Stewart's life, he was a much more complex individual than I remembered. And as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, you know, may we all benefit from the gift of history as Payne Stewart has. We all remember the guy winning the U.S. Open, kicking his fist and his foot in the air, and then immediately embracing Phil Mickelson and telling him, you know, none of this matters. You're going to be a father, and that's what matters. We remember the concession to Colin Montgomerie. We remember him sort of segueing into the position of golf's statesman of what's right and wrong in the game. We forget, this is a guy who was capable of immature and often boorish behavior, even in the process of winning major championships, in addition to being a guy who was capable of donating his entire paycheck for winning a tournament to a children's hospital. Is it fair? I guess that may not be the word, but when you're looking back on a life, should we concentrate on where he ended up more than where he came from? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and yes, I think you do. I think that's the way you judge all people is how they were in the end. We're all evolving all the time. We're all moving in one direction, sometimes imperceptibly, but you know, we're either getting better or getting worse. And we're either improving or we're not. And Payne was, demonstrably. He showed people in 1999 through his actions and his words, but mainly through his actions, that he had grown up. So, yeah, look, Payne as a young man, he ran hot. He didn't know how to manage his emotions, which is something that most elite athletes learn to do, not all, but most. And that's how they achieve greatness. And Payne achieved greatness despite that. He still was an emotional man, I believe, in 1999. But he had learned to control and manage and mitigate the emotions that had gotten him into trouble as a young man. And so, but back to your point, yeah, I think we judge somebody by who they were in the end. We have to consider their entire body of work, their entire lives. And that also is, to my mind, what makes Payne more admirable in 99. Is where he had been.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. When I was talking with some friends last weekend after a golf round about your book and about the conversation we would be having, this phrase, this term came up, and please don't think I'm intending it to have the same worldwide impact, but this was, for a lot of us, especially golf fans, this was a sports JFK moment. By that I mean everyone who was alive in 63 knows where they were when they heard the news that the president had been assassinated. For my generation, there are two. There was the Challenger explosion in 84. There was, of course, 9/11. I remember exactly where I was for both things. And as we were discussing this in a sports world, all of us remembered where we were or what we were doing that fall morning in 1999 when we heard about Payne Stewart's aircraft. Do you think that's a fair comparison to make?
Well, I wouldn't compare it in scale or scope to 9/11.
Oh, no. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Don't take it the wrong way. But just in terms of people remembering where they were when they heard the news.
Yes, that's true. Everybody I've ever talked with about this book, from the people I interviewed to friends, you know, students of mine whose parents have talked about it. Yes, they do. And I do wonder why that is. I think the first first reason is it was so unusual, and it was so mysterious. And I remember I was a reporter in St. Louis at the Post-Dispatch. We were gathered around a TV in the South County Bureau watching this thing unfold. And it went on for so long, Charlie. It was like 3 hours of televised uncertainty. And there was a plane, a Learjet 35, carrying a famous athlete. No response from inside the cockpit. And no one knew how it would end. Was this plane going to fly forever? Was it going to crash in Des Moines? It seemed like one of those days where anything was possible. And just the intrigue of it all, and the building sense of doom. This clearly was not going to end well. And no one at that time, in the moment, knew if anybody was alive on the plane. It turns out they were not. They had perished pretty early in the flight from a lack of oxygen. And by the time they hit the Florida-Alabama line, they were dead. But nobody knew that at the time. And so, yes, we remember that with great clarity because it was jolting.
The book opens with, and I read it twice because it was so stunning. Most of the time, I skip over prologues of books. I just say, whatever that is, I don't care. I'm moving to chapter one. Do not skip the prologue of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. It is a riveting account of that flight and of what, since none of us will ever really know what happened, it is as riveting an account of what probably happened as you will ever read. As I was reading it, I was wondering, who all were you able to talk to? Did you speak to the fighter pilots that were dispatched? Who did you talk to, air traffic controllers who were on duty at the time? Or did you just get that strictly from the National Transportation Safety Bureau report?
All of it came from the report.
Wow.
I just coughed. There was no need to talk to those people who had this very incidental and temporary involvement in that day. Plumbing their memories 20 years later probably wasn't going to produce anything beyond what was, and this is how detailed that report was. Entire transcript of communications to the plane, from the plane, all air traffic control communication to outbound and inbound airline pilots who were nearby in the airspace, all radio transmissions between the military pilots and their commanders on the ground. That kind of in-the-moment, authentic primary source conversation really made that, I think, that section just terribly dramatic. It was kind of hard to pull back on some. I mean, there was more detail that I thought bordered on the gratuitous, but it was really hard to know where that line was.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim. We mentioned the fact that in his early in his career and really even when he started winning major championships, Payne could be quite a pistol at times and didn't make the best decisions from a behavior standpoint. There was a moment in his life, and I got to thinking about this as I was reading your book, that in a way mirrors Tiger Woods. Follow me on this. For better or for worse, Earl Woods was sort of Tiger Woods' true north. He was his moral compass, not in his own actions, but in his words. He was a do-as-I-say, not-as-I-do kind of guy. And you can point to the unraveling of Tiger's personal life almost to the day that Earl Woods passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Bill Stewart was the guiding force in Payne Stewart's life, his true north. And he passed away before Payne realized the great success of his professional career. And I just wonder, as I was reading your book, I was wondering if he would have lived, do you think that there would have been someone to pull Payne back and say, boy, what are you doing? Stop this.
That's a really, really good question. So I never knew Payne Stewart, and I never knew Bill Stewart. Now, I did visit with Payne's sisters for quite a long time on a couple of occasions, including a personal visit to Springfield, Missouri. And we got in the car and went all over town to see the different places that Payne had been a part of. I think that Bill Stewart probably was more level and perhaps a better role model than Earl Woods. I try to be really careful in speculating. It's not what I'm.
No, that's probably knowing what we know. That's probably a safe speculation.
Yeah. And I said, Bill Stewart was a big presence too, and a big personality. He was a salesman. He's the one who suggested to Payne that he adopt some kind of look in terms of his wardrobe in order to be better remembered, to have a style, you know, have a brand. But I guess I would get the sense that Bill Stewart was a more sensible, level-headed, self-aware person who might have pulled his son aside and said a few words. That's really hard to say. It's a fascinating question, though.
Kevin, Tracy Stewart wrote a book. I was talking with someone the other day. You know, it's weird how it's been 20 years. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us, these people are frozen in time.
Yep.
Aaron Stewart's a grown man who's about to become a tournament director for an LPGA event. And when I was told that, my first reaction was, what do you mean he's 10? You know, to me, he'll always be that little boy who was there at the service. Tracy wrote a book. Did you have any contact with the family? Did you get the blessing from the family? Has there been any contact with Chelsea, Aaron, or Tracy on this book?
Yes. I did get Tracy's blessing to proceed. I thought that was important. I figured probably rightly that the people closest to Payne Stewart would be reluctant to talk with me if Tracy were unaware of the book or didn't approve of the project in the beginning. With that blessing, Tracy told me that through a letter that she didn't want to do any more interviews. I was fine with that because I wrote this book about what was happening in 99. And anything that really happened in the future, I didn't include. So there's no one looking back and reflecting on anything that happened in 99 or what Payne meant to the world of golf or anything like that. It's a very in-the-moment kind of story. And for that reason, also, I didn't need to talk to Tracy or to Chelsea and Aaron. They were 10 and 12 at the time. Their memories of that day, while I'm sure they remember some things, and those would be very painful to recount, their presence in the story didn't require me to do an interview with them, if that makes sense.
No, well, fair enough.
I wanted to talk with people who were present and part of it in 99. And most of the book, as you know, takes place on the golf course or between tournaments or something like that. October 25th, 99 takes up some pages in the book, as do the following 4 days. And the book's over on that Sunday after Tiger Woods wins the tour championship. That's the end of the story. So the bulk of the interviews I did were with people like players, his caddy, Mike Hicks, his coach, Chuck Cook, his friends back in Dallas, who were present and had a part in Payne's life in 1999. So Tracy and I did speak. She did read the manuscript before copy editing. She corrected some errors. I'm grateful for that. And her overall, I feel like I can paraphrase her overall impression of the book, that she thought that I used too many negative media portrayals of Payne. And that's fair. You know, like I think to myself, if this story were about my spouse, I probably would be disappointed too. And as the writer of this book, I probably would have been in more peril, in more trouble, if Tracy Stewart had loved the story, because then I wouldn't be beholden to the truth. I'd be doing another authorized biography.
Get you out of here on this. Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim, a person who is, to me, a prominent, if it's possible to be a prominent person in the background, he is. And he's mentioned several times in the book. He was a big presence at the Ryder Cup. And I'm speaking of Hal Sutton. And because of the proximity of their names alphabetically, Stewart and Sutton, they many times were lockered right next to each other, week in, week out on the PGA Tour. And as such, there was a relationship between those two guys. The last time we spoke, you had just written a brilliant piece on Hal Sutton, I believe, for Golf Digest. And we spoke at that time. I'm sure you had more than one conversation with Hal Sutton about Payne Stewart. Or maybe you didn't. It struck me that Hal Sutton's the kind of guy who, once he had spoken on the subject, He had spoken on it. We weren't going to talk about it anymore. And he's sort of like the last John Wayne left in this town. And he got up and rode off. Did Hal have anything to say, or did he sort of look at you and say, Kevin, I love you, but everything I've said is on the record somewhere else?
No, we did speak. Hal Sutton is a very eloquent storyteller. And in one of the interviews that we did for this book, he started remembering that Saturday night at the Ryder Cup. And that is a story that has been told from a lot of different points of view over the years. It was the team meeting after Ben Crenshaw wagged his finger at the press conference and said something about fate. The American team was down 10-6. It looked insurmountable for a single Sunday. But they needed something. They needed something to hold on to. And so Saturday night, they went around the room, each player, and talked about why that moment was important to them. They couldn't talk about the golf. The golf seemed so beside the point. And Hal told me this story about breaking down walls. And he described how on the PGA Tour, because it's an individual sport, players don't really reveal much in a soul way to their peers. Because there's this, it really is quite irrational, but there's this idea that if I tell you who I really am, you're somehow going to use that against me on the golf course. If I tell you my secrets, you're going to reveal them on the golf course. It's a strange, strange thing, but I get it. And that night, those walls came down. And my sense of the story is that, yeah, Hal and Payne knew each other because of the proximity of their lockers, but not until that Saturday night did they really know each other. And they stayed up late. They were the last two guys standing. And they decided, well, they were going to do this together and that. They were going to go fishing, and Hal was going to teach Payne how to ride a horse. And when they became Ryder Cup captains, the other would be the vice captain. They made plans. They had dreams. And a month later, Payne got on the plane.
That's author Kevin Robbins, his book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year Golf Changed Forever. And Kurt Sampson's book, Roaring Back, The Fall and Rise of Tiger Woods, I cannot recommend highly enough. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today? Hey, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Well, weather-wise, you might have to dodge some falling water here and there, but still unseasonably warm, and that means plenty of great opportunity in the Carolinas for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart this weekend. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.